to this class, which is the next one. I don't know what number. It says it's number 7. Maybe, perhaps it's number 7. Probably. Who cares? Theodore Roosevelt. I wonder if I put his name. Have I written his name in French accidentally there? I may have done. Nope, that's how you write it. Okay, Theodore Roosevelt, born in 1858, died in 1919, American politician, 26th President of the United States. Do you know anything about Theodore Roosevelt?
Yes.
No? That's important, yeah, that's important. I will come to that in a moment.
Well, it was the president that wanted to set a very masculine portrait of him, and as an example, he sometimes pictured himself as a cowboy.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
And was doing some wrestling as well.
Wrestling, yeah. Yep, that's right. What, one last fact about Theodore Roosevelt.
It was for his progressive.
Now that's kind of a matter of opinion, but compared with most of the presidents, yes.
He got
a Nobel Peace Prize. He was the first American president to get a Nobel Peace Prize. Now, Nobel Peace Prizes, you know, some really good people get them, but not everybody who gets them is, you know, necessarily that wonderful. I'm thinking of Kissinger, for example. Okay, fine. So let's get started. One of the things you'll remember about the back. Why can't you see this better than this? Is it there's too much light? Oh well, never mind. And remember, I showed you the statue of Theodore Roosevelt on horseback, and here you have the Native American, and here you have the African American, and who are obviously very happy to let him have the only horse that they have. Yeah, I'm sure that they loved that they were really, yeah. So particular images of the past of the United States, and indeed in this document, we will see quite a lot of what we would today consider reactionary views. Yeah, there's a whole section on how can we bring the American Indians to civilization. Yeah, so they very much the ideas of the time. You're quite right that he was. You know, it's kind of nice to get a prize or to get a Grammy or something. But if when you've died, somebody says, "Hey, let's make a mountain of her." That's pretty cool. That's pretty up there. The Mount Rushmore is created 7 or 8 years after Theodore Roosevelt's death. And so there are 4 presidents up there. And so Roosevelt is the last of the 4 presidents on Mount Rushmore, which, you know, makes him a bit of a national hero. I mean, at least an establishment hero. And here is the whole those all 4 of them. There is all 4 of them. I can't name all of them. I'm certainly Lincoln and other founding fathers. So founding considered as a founding father of the United States. And indeed, it's not surprising in the sense that he became prime minister in 1901. And this was just around the time when America was saying, "Hey, we're the biggest country in the world. What do we do with this?" You know. So it's obviously, you know, it's an easier time to become a national hero than most. Now, making people into mountains is a particularly ambitious form of hero worship. You know, I don't think any French presidents have yet said, "Hey, make a mountain of me." Although I'm not promising over the next month, you never know. But there you go. And you know. Reminds me a little bit, although this is a comparison which is not often made. Here we have another enormously huge statue. Can you see how big it is? These are people. These are people. An enormously huge statue. And this, of course, is Joseph Stalin. So this idea of, you know, huge hero worship is not reserved to any particular power bloc. More importantly, the teddy bear was invented and named after Theodore Roosevelt. That's the really important thing about him, you know, with politics and economics. Yeah. So, and this is the original teddy bear. It became popular in 1902. I mean, when I say popular, I mean extremely popular, to such an extent that it's still popular today, although people have forgotten why it's called a teddy bear. Interestingly enough. In fact, the reason it's a bit bizarre. I mean, it's basically somebody who suddenly realised there was a market for soft toys. Very well designed, I must say. We see it as a teddy bear, but in fact, to make this design is not so easy to invent. And the reason for it is that apparently Roosevelt went on a hunting trip where the objective was to kill a bear. But he didn't manage to kill a bear, and his servants his staff were so worried about this that they actually caught a bear and tied it to a tree and beat it until it was completely alive. And they said, Mr. Roosevelt, go and shoot that bear. And apparently Theodore Roosevelt said, hey, no, that's not cricket, you know, that's not ethical to shoot bears, which are, I mean, I think shooting bears in general is pretty easy, but you know, anyway, it's too much for him to shoot a wounded bear, and so this is the, that, it may not be very important, but I like it. So, let's see what happened to him first. The most important thing, somebody just did this to me in the corridor, you mustn't confuse him with Franklin Roosevelt, who is much later, okay? People do, one of my colleagues did this morning. They are in fact distant cousins. So what kind of family did Franklin Roosevelt come from? Well, probably best described as a patrician family. That is to say that they were part of the elites, but they considered it was their job to deal with the general questions of how society was run. Now, if you're beginning from the point of view of the text commentary, then the first thing we do, who is he? And we can compare him with some of the other people, because he is a little different. He is the president of what is rapidly becoming the most powerful country in the world. So completely different from Nelson Mandela. The speech from Nelson Mandela, when he gives this speech, everybody thinks he is about to be executed a few weeks later. That's the general opinion. Nelson Mandela is speaking from a position where he has no power. And this guy is speaking from a position of power. Not the same kind of power as last week's hero, Carnegie, because of course Carnegie was economic power, and this is political power. Political power. So obviously from the establishment, you don't get to be president if you're not part of the establishment, really. I suppose it's imaginable, but it's not very easy. So distant cousins of Franklin, where did his family make their money from? They made their money from real estate, as you say in America. In Britain we say just as, I don't know, what do we say in England? Land, you make it from land. As you know today, if you want to buy a flat in New York, you go to a real estate agent. And if you want to buy a garage in London, you go to an estate agent. Yeah, estate agent in Britain and real estate agent in America. That's just the difference of the language. So, they made their money through real estate and also from sugar trading. Theodore Roosevelt is the leading politician, the star politician of the first decade of the 20th century. He is remembered for innovations in domestic policy and in foreign policy. He sets up the way that the United States is going to deal with being so powerful. And he's remembered for one or two famous quotes. The only one which I think is really, really famous is apparently he spoke, when he was speaking about foreign policy, he said, the best thing to do is to speak softly but carry a big stick. To speak softly but carry a big stick. So he had the sense of the, he had a sense of aphorism. Born 1858 then, a sickly child. He suffered from asthma when he was young. Now asthma these days, we know what to do with it, so it's not so bad. Asthma was a really much more serious at the time, as almost everything was. His mother was a southerner from the south of the United States, who regretted the defeats of the South in the Civil War, who regretted the defeat of the Confederacy. But because his mother was a southerner, his father never joined the army during the Civil War. And this was considered by Theodore to be a sign of shame, a shameful thing from his family that they didn't fight in the great American Civil War. And that will have some effect on him later. He loved sports when he was young, and very rapidly, very young, he was elected very young to the New York State legislature. And in general, I mean, he was progressive in the sense that he was opposed to corruption. He wanted government to be effective and to keep the new industrial economy going. Yeah, obviously corruption is unethical, but it's also a problem for economies. That if companies cannot say, "Oh, I know what's going to happen next year," then that blocks up the economy somewhat. He was in favour of modernisation and against what they call old corruption. And old corruption is, "Oh, yeah, I have a nephew who can help you," you know, this kind of thing. He lost his wife. His wife died when he was in his 20s. So she died giving birth, which was still an extremely dangerous thing to do. And he lost his mother the same week, and his reaction was to head west go and have a break in North Dakota. This is where North Dakota is. It's up here. Yeah. Just with this little map, we're reminded of the most important thing about 19th century America. Look at the lines of the states. Yeah, you can see that the local people, it was not a problem. We just draw a line. It's like looked like Africa at the time. So what did he want to do in North Dakota? There he is, dressed as a cowboy. And not just dressed as a cowboy, he really felt himself to be a cowboy. And he went to North Dakota, and his objective was to shoot a buffalo. There were not so many buffaloes left, actually, by this time, but his objective was to shoot a buffalo, and he spent many weeks organizing so he could shoot a buffalo, and did. And he stayed in North Dakota for some time, a couple of years, I think, but I'm not sure. And he bought a ranch. Well, that's what you do, isn't it, when you go on holiday, buy a ranch. Yeah, that's what I do. He got involved in cattle raising. The United States is becoming a huge base for the meat industry, because somebody has just invented the refrigerated railway truck. Yeah, so you could move tons and tons of meat around on rails, and this is obviously a big deal. And in general, throughout this story, you will see, you know, the huge new technology coming in and making a difference. I showed you last week about the rise, the explosive rise of the railroad. Eventually he will lose a lot of money in cattle raising, because he wasn't very good at it, but it's all right, he had enough money to lose it. Don't worry about him, he'll be fine. His biographers speak of this period in North Dakota as the moment when Theodore Roosevelt learned the true manly values of America. And himself, he spoke in that way. In the West, he became a real man. He learned to ride a wild horse. Can you ride a wild horse? Yeah, you're not a real man. Yeah, that was the thing at the time. You know, this is cowboy country. Yeah, get off your horse and drink your milk. You know, and this town ain't big enough for the both of us, and so on and so forth. But he comes back and he gets it, and he gets married, and he becomes quite well known as a writer and makes quite a lot of money from writing The Winning of the West in four volumes, which is, you know, how America conquered the West, which doesn't just mean conquering the Native Americans. It also means, you know, then building towns. Building towns when the railways were not yet there. Yeah, so look at the infrastructure which was necessary. This was a big success, this book, and by now he is 30 years old, and he's very pleased because war breaks out. There is a war between the United States and Spain. The United States and Spain, yeah. In particular, over who will control Cuba and some parts of Mexico. I don't know the great details, but there's a war against Spain, and he is very pleased because this is his chance to join the army, and he will join the army, and his regiment or his group will be known as the Rough Riders of Roosevelt. Yeah, the Rough Riders of Roosevelt. We are the cowboys, we're the best, and so on. And he certainly believed that war was a wonderful thing for nations. So this is these manly values. And he says, I have a quotation from him, "It is through strife that a nation reaches greatness." Yeah, because at this time the elite of America said, well, we're a very new country. How can we become a great country like Greece or Russia or France? Only joking. So he wants the United States to become the great imperialist, because we can already see that Britain, which is the biggest imperialist by a long way, Britain is beginning to overstretch itself. Germany has a bigger industry than Britain. The United States has a bigger industry than Britain. So the more far-sighted among the elite, where Britain is, it's not going to collapse quickly. But Theodore Roosevelt is determined that the United States should replace Britain as the major world imperialist, and of course, not him personally is successful, but it does happen that way. He's president at the. He becomes vice president in 1900 for McKinley, from a rather cynical point of view, he has a stroke of luck for his career in that McKinley is assassinated. I know that's not a very nice thing to say, that it's good news for his career, but McKinley is assassinated, and he becomes president He becomes president in 1901 because the president is assassinated. And 3 years later, it is, as perhaps you know, in the United States, if something happens to a president, the vice president becomes president, and they don't organize an election. They wait for the next one. And indeed, in 1904, he was re-elected. He was elected. He got a second term. And I was studying this last week, and I found that there was somebody on the internet who explained it better than me. So we're going to have don't tell my boss. But so we're going to have 5 minutes video here in theory, and just an advert first. Now what I need to do here is see if I can turn up the sound. Yeah, I think I can turn it up here. Yes. Five minutes video, so I get a rest.
Popular. Some fellow Republicans, however, called him a radical due to his progressive policies, and they try to get Mark Hanna to run against him as the official nominee. However, Hanna died in February, and no serious contender could replace Hanna to rise to compete with Roosevelt. So Roosevelt was the nominee. But to make the conservatives happy, the Republicans nominated Charles Fairbanks, the likable senator from Indiana, as his running mate. The Democrats had a hard time finding a strong nominee that could compete with Roosevelt. William Jennings Bryan didn't want to run a third time, and they even asked Grover Cleveland to run again, but he turned it down too. A lot of Bryan's supporters flocked to the New York newspaper publisher turned U.S. Representative William Randolph Hearst, but Hearst frankly scared many Democrats to death. So many of them turned to Alton Parker, the chief judge of the New York Court of Appeals. They nominated Henry Davis, a former senator from West Virginia, as his running mate. At 80 years old, Davis was the oldest major party candidate ever to be nominated for national office. I will mention two third parties for this election. A new political party called the Socialist Party of America, or just Socialist Party for short, nominated a well-known socialist, perhaps one of the original socialists, Eugene Debs. Debs ran and lost in 1900, but his support seemed to be growing now. The Socialist Party nominated Ben Hanford, a printer based out of New York, as his running mate. The Prohibition Party wasn't going away. They nominated Silas Swallow, a Methodist preacher from Pennsylvania with an awkward name, with George Washington Carroll, a Texas oilman and lumberman, as his running mate. The campaigning in 1904 was fairly low-key. Maybe it was because most everyone knew Alton Parker didn't stand a chance against the popular Roosevelt. While Roosevelt was charismatic and energetic, Parker was boring and didn't even get Democrats excited. Plus, Parker and Roosevelt agreed on most issues, so this election became more about the difference between their personalities. And here are the results. Theodore Roosevelt easily won re-election. In fact, it was a landslide. Roosevelt received 336 electoral votes, and Alton Parker only received 140 electoral votes. Roosevelt absolutely dominated everywhere except the South. Roosevelt became the first Republican to win the state of Missouri since 1868. The popular vote was just as lopsided, with Roosevelt getting 56.4% and Parker getting just 37.6%. Came in third, not winning electoral votes, but getting a respectable 3% of the popular vote. Silas Swallow came in fourth, getting 1.9% of the popular vote. Charles Fairbanks became the 26th vice president in American history. Teddy Roosevelt became the first president to win an election after becoming president not by election in American history. I'll see you for the next election, buddy.
Okay, that gave me a nice rest. You'll notice that the Prohibition Party is still a real thing. 2% is obviously not huge, but nonetheless it's a real political presence. So the anti-alcohol parties, so there's something very special, of course, about the United States political culture. So he became president at the age of 43. And as was mentioned, I'm going to repeat some of the things in the video because it all went very fast. As was mentioned, first of all, for those people who like houses and furniture, the West Wing was created for Theodore Roosevelt. and as they mentioned in the video, he decided to use the press in a particular way. Now, this was important. In fact, universal literacy was just arriving. Certainly, this is the time in Britain when all the big newspapers are founded. The Daily Mail is founded in the 1890s. The Daily Mirror, the Times is much older. But a whole series of popular newspapers selling millions every day are the new event in the United States and in Britain in the 1890s. That's the time of the time of mass newspapers. It's also about the technology of print getting easy. And so instead of considering journalists as just a nuisance, he created a room for them in the White House and launched the press briefing. He was also quite good at manipulating them, you know. So, well, you know, I'm going to announce, I think I'll leak this next week, you know, the organized leaks which have become normal politics around the world. So there is his result then. The numbers are the the numbers on the states are the number of electoral votes, because as you know, it works by a system of, how do you say that in English, corps électeur? You can say that. I really study Britain, I can't remember what it's called in America. So they all get the North is absolutely solid. That is to say, the industrial North and the agricultural South is not so happy. It's still a shoe. What is happening here? Chicago. That's where the industry is. Chicago and New York and now something which will become important and which he mentions a lot in this speech. Is Washington D.C. Just down the right here. You remember what the status of Washington is? Washington D.C. a state?
No, it's a district.
Yeah. So what happens? Does it have a government? Because all the other states have their state governments. So what happens in Washington D.C.?
It's a district.
It is a district. Yeah, but who governs it? Yeah, say again.
I have to go back there.
I
know that there is the state of Washington.
Yeah. That's different. Yeah, yeah. The state of Washington is up here. Washington, D.C. is down here. Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
That's right. It is governed directly by the federal government. So it's an anomaly, really. You have all the state governments, and then the federal government organizes federal issues and Washington D.C. issues, every now and then there is a campaign, make Washington D.C. a state, and it gets thousands and thousands of signatures, but nobody's ever done it. And in this document, Roosevelt speaks about Washington D.C. And when he has ideas about the best ways to govern, he says, and the federal government should give an example. We should do this in Washington D.C. And the other states will see that we're doing things. In particular, he's talking about bad housing, solving the problem of bad housing. And when I say bad housing, I'm talking like three families in a room, no toilets, etc. Yeah, really, really bad housing. What we would call in English slums. Now, slums is important. He mentions it a few times. It's a part of town with extremely poor housing. Now, this is rather difficult to translate into French, because if in French you say bidonville, we imagine a place where people have built their own house with whatever they had, and that's not a slum. A slum, it's professionally built housing, which is very old, very bad quality, very overcrowded, etc. Yes. It's telepathy, it's telepathy. The problem is, when you're translating in an article the word slum, very often you have to say, les quartiers les plus délabrés, you don't have the full paraphrase, don't you know? Yeah, there is not just one word for it. He talks a lot about that. No, still in 1904, here is the poster or the symbol that he used, and although this is 1904, he's still got the monocle, which seems to have completely gone out of fashion. Nobody at all has a monocle these days. I've never seen anybody with a monocle, which is interesting, because most things never absolutely disappear. There's always a small minority, but like punk hairstyles and stuff. Anyway, there you go. So the monocle. It's not a monocle, is it? He's got two. It's another sort of. It's a pince-nez. That's to say, there is nothing to go over the ears. It's just on there. So it's not quite a monocle. It's still extremely uncomfortable, I think. Yeah. Have you ever tried one? No. I think this thing over the ears. Is a good idea. Okay, so let me move. A little later, he will move against the Republican Party, and he will stand in 1912 as a progressive candidate. That is to say, he will form a new party. But that is considerably after this document, so we're going to leave that. Now, this document is the annual message. But today it has another name. What is the name of the annual message from the president these days? It's quite well known. No. That's a more informal thing. Yeah. It's the State of the Union message. Yeah. The State of the Union. Every year, the American president gives a long speech about a lot of different questions. The State of the Union. That is, where are we in the United States? The State of the Union. And this is one of the early ones. But they didn't yet use the State of the Union. This is called the Annual Message. You may have noticed it's quite long. And he talks about many, many different subjects. And obviously, what is new about Roosevelt? First of all, then, what is new in foreign policy? So he has this idea of the Rough Rider, the manly virtues. We need a virile military to help expand the influence of the United States. Just before he became president, in 1898, there was. No, was it just before? No, it was finished when he was at. No, I'm sorry. Just after he became president, there's this question about the Philippines. From 1899 until 1902, for 3 years, there is a war between the Philippines and America because America has decided to annex the Philippines. Yes, 1899 to 1902. Yeah, so it's already started when he becomes president, and it continues. And this war to conquer the Philippines, to colonize the Philippines, gave rise to one of the most famous imperialist poems in history by a British colonialist poet, Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling is famous for writing the Jungle Book, some of the stuff he wrote was politically more doubtful than the Jungle Book. So this is his very, very famous poem, which is written to say to encourage the United States to annex the Philippines because the inferior races need us. Okay, yeah, so ça mérite la clarté, il cache pas son jeu. And here you see it here, take up the white man's burden. He's talking to the United States, he said, vous devez porter le fardeau de l'homme blanc, notre lourde responsabilité de civiliser les sauvages. Ooh, this is not so fashionable anymore. And so, take up the white man's burden, send forth the best ye breed. Yeah. Send your best sons to the colonies to control the colonies. Go bind your sons to exile to serve your captives' needs. And we're doing all this for the good of the people in the Philippines or in Africa, etc. What will your sons do when they get to the colonies? They will wait in heavy harness. They must work very hard to care for the fluttered folk and wild, les peuples sauvage et confuse dans la tête, half devil and half child. Yes, sir. I mean, this is really the top peak imperialism here. Take up the white man's burden in patience to abide, to veil the threat of terror and check the show of pride by open speech and simple, 100 times made plain to seek another's profit and work another's gain. There are 6 more verses, but I think that's enough. You get the idea. Yeah. So this is interesting because this became in world history the symbol of the attitude of colonialism. It's good, of course, Rudyard Kipling. He's also a very good writer. Yeah. So this is the symbol, and this was very much the position, of course, of the United States. So the Philippines was annexed, and this is what will inspire Roosevelt, and will also inspire him to his slogan: "Speak softly, but carry a big stick." Roosevelt's attitude to foreign policy will become known as Roosevelt's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. It's a bizarre thing to do. Roosevelt's corollary to the Monroe Doctrine. That's what we call it, yeah. Corollary.
Can you spell?
I can. C-O-R-O-L-L-A-R-Y. C-O-R-O-L-L-A-R-Y. A-R-Y. Corollary means correspondence, yeah. His equivalent. Now, the Monroe Doctrine, as you know, and as I found out last week, was invented in 1823. And basically, 1823 says that the Monroe Doctrine says the whole of America, North and South America, is the interest sphere of the United States, and Europeans must not touch it. Now, that's basically in two words. And so, as we shall see later, Roosevelt is involved in reorganizing Latin America, parts of it. He will also get the Nobel Peace Prize for his intervention in the war between Russia and Japan in 1905. Now, these are properly imperialist wars because the Russian Empire and the Japanese Empire both want bits of China and bits of Korea. It's not war of one imperialist against the colony. Yeah? These are fights over who gets bits of China, and Japan got most of it. In fact, Japan won the war. Also bits of Korea, the Korean Empire. In any case, Russia thought that they could win. The Japanese won. This is also a very interesting war, if you're interested in wars. It's a very interesting war. It's the first place we ever saw trench warfare. Yeah, la guerre des tranchées is invented in the Russian-Japanese war. Before that, it didn't exist. And Theodore Roosevelt organized the arbitration and helped write the Treaty of Portsmouth, which ended the Treaty of Portsmouth. The Portsmouth is a not very pretty little town in the south of England, and that ended the war between Russia and Japan. The defeat of Russia caused a lot of problems for the Russian aristocracy and helped lead to the 1905 Russian Revolution, the first Russian Revolution. From the Russian-Japanese War, here we have a Japanese drawing, and you can see Russia is this horrible monster trying to take over bits of Turkey, bits of China, Tibet, and so on and so forth. It's not supposed to be objective, okay? This is the meanies. So let's look at the domestic policy then. I will come back to some of the important things which Roosevelt actually did in foreign policy, in particular in Panama. But let's in domestic policy, the first thing that he the first thing that he did was he campaigned for a much stronger federal government. And in fact, many people think that he introduced 20th century state capitalism, where in fact, of course, it's still big companies are important, but state regulation is extremely important to limit the freedoms of big companies. In particular, he introduced antitrust legislation, which make it, in certain circumstances, illegal to have a monopoly. There will still be some monopolies, but there will be the monopolies will be controlled by state legislation. And this is sometimes what we call the beginnings of state capitalism. Some of the nicer things he did were to extend the National Park Scheme. So it's under Roosevelt that the Grand Canyon becomes a national park, and so the mining companies are not allowed to mine there, etc. Yeah? It's a protection of nature to some extent. And of course, people like this stuff, but you know, sometimes you think, oh yeah, well, Hitler was very nice to his cats. Sometimes you think it might not have such historical weights. So this is the moment when the role of federal government becomes much more important. The presidential speeches become much more important. There's much more federal intervention to regulate capitalism. And in this book you will have seen, in this speech you will have seen, that he says, yes, we need to follow the example of some European countries, that they are introducing legislation, for example, on housing and limiting overcrowding. So this is moving away from the idea that, oh, well, the market will solve the problem, and saying that we need state intervention. In Britain is the one I know best, after the 1830s, you very slowly get laws to make life better in towns. For example, one of the laws, the national laws in Britain, says local town councils may, if they wish, ask for taxes from the population in order to install sewage, les égouts. But notice, if they wish, the national government does not say every town must have sewage. They say if they wish, they may. And then later on, even for education, it will be the same. The first laws will say local governments have the right to organise free schools if they wish. It's not a very centralised thing, so very different from French history, where things tend to happen in the centre. There are also in the 1848, in particular, in Britain, laws about the Factory Acts, which limits, you know, how long you can work if you're under 12, and so on. I mean, the limits sound kind of amusing to us today, because they're so, you know, so, oh yeah, no more than 10 hours a day if you're under 8. Oh yeah, cool. It's, you know, but they are a beginning. Now, 1901, Theodore Roosevelt becomes president, and a few years later he tries. And you saw that in 1904 the Socialist Party got 3%. Now, this is the moment of one of the big mysteries of American history. In every major industrial country between 1890 and 1910. A massive socialist party was established. In France, you have the SFEU. In Germany, you have the Sozialdemokratische Partei. In Italy, you have the Partito Socialista. In Japan, you have a socialist party. In Australia, you have a socialist party. I'm talking about a party which has millions of voters. A mass socialist party, not a little. And in America, there wasn't one. There was just a small one. There's never been a mass socialist party in America of any sort. And so this is a mystery. I have an idea, but it's too long to talk about. Yeah. Basically, the importance of new immigrants made it more difficult to stabilise a working class base for a party, and the Democratic Party succeeded in playing some of the roles which the Socialist Party played in Spain, Italy. I mean, it really is surprising that when you look at the 20 industrialized countries in 1900, 19 of them have a Socialist Party, a mass Socialist Party, and one does not. So it is something that needs explaining. And as you know, historians are people who like the question, why? This is also the moment in Britain in 1906, when the Liberal government will introduce the first old age pensions, the first free school meals, the very beginnings, the very small beginnings of the welfare state. We see some of this in Roosevelt's speech, that he suggests that it's a good thing to improve people's housing, etc. That's Theodore Roosevelt giving a speech. Yeah. So this is the area of U.S. Imperialism, intervention and influence abroad, economic intervention, political intervention, diplomatic intervention, cultural intervention. U.S. imperialism is rather specific, because the U.S. presidents in general, they will denounce European colonialism. Remember, of course, the United States was colonies and then became independent, and so they will generally say, oh, you know, look how terrible European colonialism is. And indeed, in the very beginning of the 1890s, so only 10 years before, the European powers decide to divide Africa. So France, Germany, Britain, Italy, just a little bit for Italy and Germany, Denmark, a little tiny bit. I've forgotten somebody, haven't I? I think that's those are the main ones. And they have the Treaty of Berlin. There is no African in the room. There is literally no African in the room. And they divide Africa up between them. But what is interesting is that they do this at a moment when one of the biggest economies in the world is absent. There is no US colony in Africa. But in a way, they had the economic power, but they didn't have the political. They didn't have the political do it. So they denounce European colonialism, but they start looking outward. They've already been beginning to look outward during the Civil War. In 1868, they take Alaska. They buy Alaska. By 1910, half of Mexico is controlled by the United States. In 1898, Hawaii is annexed. And 2 years later, the Philippines. Yeah, so there is a certain expansionism. Now, the Philippine situation was particularly bloody. 200,000 people, 200,000 Filipinos died in the war against the United States. The United States intervened in Cuba under Roosevelt in 1906, and there will be later interventions in Cuba. But perhaps the big symbolic one is the question of the Panama Canal. When Panama was a Spanish colony, a canal was planned, but 200 years later it had not been built. In the 1850s, the work began. Large numbers of African and Chinese workers were brought to Panama to build the railroad. At this time, Panama didn't exist as a country. It was Colombia. It was part of Colombia. 12,000 workers died of tropical diseases. It was very difficult to build the Panama Canal, more difficult than the Suez Canal. The Suez Canal had already been built. Some of the engineers were French. And these French engineers went over to Panama and said, hey, let's build one here too, with the local money. But it was much more difficult because in Suez, well, first of all, Suez was not built in jungle. Yeah. And secondly, the Suez Canal is a flat canal. It's all at sea level. This was not possible in Panama. They had to make locks, des écluses. Des écluses. Anyway, the United States decided it was important to have a canal in Panama. The canal is 80 kilometers long. 80 kilometers long. However, it avoids you having to go around South America, which is 6 months. It takes 6 months to go around here, so yeah, you can see why there was power. So what happened, you see, in 1902, the French had begun the work, but then they'd gone bankrupt. In 1902, under Roosevelt, the United States wanted to buy the land to make the canal, but Colombia refused to sign the treaty. And so the United States financed the local Panama people who wanted independence and obliged Colombia to give independence to Panama so they could build the canal. It was finished in 1913, involving the largest dam on earth at the time. It cost $350 million. And in January 1914, the first ship crossed the Panama went through the Panama Canal. So obviously, a huge transformation of trade. Are incomparable. Incidentally, you can't go around the top either. No? Just checking. You knew this. Yeah. Don't do it. It's a waste of time. So there you go. The United States will control the Panama Canal Zone until the 1970s. Yeah, they will control it to the 1970s. Then there was a new arrangement. So if we look at the speech itself, well, it is very wide-ranging. It's very wide-ranging. You see, at one point he talks about the post office and the importance of postal deliveries. At another point he talks about the Indians, or as we would say, Native Americans. That's another point he talks about, housing. And just another point he talks about, foreign country, foreign policy. So very wide ranging. This is in accordance with the United States contribution, the United States Constitution. Article 2 of the Constitution requires that the President shall, from time to time, give to the Congress information of the State of the Union. He defends his plan to intervene in Latin America. He talks of the need for trade unions. So in this sense, he's defending a modern idea of capitalism, where you have trade unions, but they are limited. Where it is necessary to have health and safety laws. In particular, he talks about the railroads, or as we would say, the railways. And he says, well, let's look at the railways in Germany, the railways in Britain, the railways in America. Why are so many more workers and passengers killed on American railways? We cannot simply trust the private companies to keep their workers safe. We need federal legislation to oblige a minimum respect for safety. Okay, so I think those are the most important things I was going to say there. Yeah, we need to rationalize capitalism through state intervention. Okay, so I'm hoping that I can look at two extracts here, which I also have to mark down. First of all, about Native Americans, and then secondly, about foreign policy. So let me see if I can find them. Let me see if I can find glasses already.